Welcome back to Ben and Matt's Marvelous Journey. We have made it 4 episodes, and I'm just proud of us. My name is Matt. I am Matt Waters. I am a co-host of basically everything that's ever been on the real world. EnterTheRealWorld.com. That's 2 E's. Mike Thomas recently realized that both our URL and our Twitter handle are bad when it comes to reading them out loud. Oh well, I am joined by Ben Phillips, my wonderful co-host, my wonderful fellow Brit. How are you this very eve, Benjamin?
I am good. I watched Thor last night. I think it's all fresh in my head.
Yeah. I also watched Thor last night. We watched it about, I think you were on like a half hour head start from me. I don't know. But
I did pause it a lot. I had to read the certain political things that leaked at the start of it. So.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going to say what they were to date this episode.
You mean like when I just rampantly talked about Star Wars and the Incredible Hulk episode? Anyway,
yes.
So it's Thor time. It's Thor, everyone. We are in a Tony Stark-free zone, although his name is mentioned. So this is Thor, released May 6th, 2011. The only comic book movie to come out since the one we discussed in our last episode, I meant it, is Jonah Hex, which made zero impact on anyone in the world. And they made this for $150 million, same budget as Incredible Hulk. Less money than Iron Man 2. You have to earn that sequel money, everyone. And on that 150, it made just shy of 450, which, more than Hulk, less than both the Iron Mans. Respectable, I'd say. You know, at this stage of the game, they're making healthy profits. Something I forgot to mention in the Iron Man 1 podcast is that Jon Favreau stated that when he made Iron Man, they told him they'd be happy with a Fox level of money. They just didn't want him to screw anything up going forward. And it's like, that's quite a statement considering what Marvel is today. And it's directed by Kenneth Branagh. Shakespeare extraordinaire Kenneth Branagh. Written by, this is a recurring theme now. We're going to see a lot of films in this early stage written by people that we will just not hear from again. I guess Marvel were just sort of looking for mercenaries at this stage. Ashley Edward Miller and Zach Stentz, who wrote X-Men First Class. Don Payne, a veteran of The Simpsons and Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer. So both ends of the spectrum there. With some story by J. Michael Straczynski, who wrote many, many comics, notably Thor.
And we'll probably mention that later.
Yes, and Mark Protosevic. Should have tried saying that out loud before now. He wrote I Am Legend, and he also was writing the never-made Batman and Robin sequel. So there you go. And this is also the second shortest film so far behind Incredible Hulk.
Wasn't Protosevic also the guy who's going to be doing that, like, human-dinosaur hybrid Jurassic Park movie?
Yes, he and Steven Spielberg had a meeting and it didn't go well. I think he took the hybrid thing from him and went forward, but left the human aspect behind.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense.
It does.
To tangent back, I haven't actually looked at the cast for Jonah Hex, and I didn't realise how good the cast for that movie was.
Oh, there's so many bad comic book movies who have just, like, amazing casts. We were talking about The Losers the other week, and how that is just a murderer's row of people that would become big stars.
But this is Josh Brolin, John Malkovich, Megan Fox, Michael Fassbender, Michael Shannon, Lance Reddick, and Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Wow.
Like, some of those are in, like, small roles, but, like, that's a pretty stacked guy. Also, does Jeffrey Dean Morgan have the worst taste in comic book movies?
Apparently. Look.
The Losers, Jonah Hex, Watchmen.
If someone offered you Batman a role in Watchmen before it existed, you would fucking leap at it.
But I just listed the 4 comic movies he's done.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
They're all pretty bad.
I don't think he's wrong for choosing that. It doesn't matter. He's not in this film, so we're not talking about him. So
Hasn't he shown up in a Marvel movie? He feels like the kind of actor who probably would show up in a Marvel movie.
Look, before Marvel is said and done, every actor with a SAG credit is going to be in a Marvel movie.
Also completely forgot he's bloody Negan in The Walking Dead, so he's literally got the worst taste in comic book properties.
Heavy shots at The Walking Dead, which I've never seen or read, but I think is terrible.
Okay, the comic book is good. The TV show is not good.
Okay.
To put it mildly.
Alright, well, you heard it here first, folks. The Walking Dead is not good. So Sam Raimi, of all people, was trying to make a Thor movie in the 90s, and he sat down with Stan Lee, and Stan Lee did not understand, so Marvel passed. And then X-Men happened, and that gave them new hope, so they were actually producing it for television at one point, with Tyler Mane as Thor. Who's Tullamain, I hear you ask? Well, he played Sabretooth in X-Men 1, so very good call there. I mean, you know, he may look like a giant blonde Viking man, but that dude cannot act. The normal money and production hell stuff stops that happening. The rights move around from Sony to Paramount. David Goyer, Matthew Vaughn, and Guillermo del Toro all were in talks at one time or another. But they finally landed on Kenneth Branagh, and they finally, you know, by the time all this stuff had happened, as we've chronicled in the last few episodes, they established their own movie studio. And they thought, right, it's Thor time. Thor is a, if not a very famous comic book character, everyone like is tangentially aware of what Thor is as a mythological character, so it's a safe one to go with, and fans of the comics think fondly of Thor.
It's interesting you say you think it's like people are aware of him. I think this was the biggest risk that Marvel made in its initial Phase One lineup.
I'd say Iron Man was.
I think Robert Downey Jr. to it, that's true, but I do think that there is a level of Iron Man has a concept that you can see where the concept is going to go, whereas Thor is basically, he's a god, he's also an alien.
Before Marvel Studios exists, if you sit me down and say, right, we have options to make movies about these five characters, which one should we not do? I would probably pick Iron Man, but that sounds crazy now because that's the money-making character. But I think, you know, the other four have a larger sort of cultural profile. So
I just think this movie had a more difficult road ahead of it in terms of it had to have Asgard work and it had to have it mesh with the kind of more science realistic take that they had been doing with the other three movies in the series. So this movie being the fourth one is a crazy risk.
Absolutely.
That massively pays off down the line.
Thank you, Tiger.
With other movies.
Thank you, Joss.
I was also going to say, like, Guardians of the Galaxy is probably the most obvious successor to the kind of universe that kind of Thor lets them jump into.
Yes.
But, like, in terms of, you look at that slate of the first five movies, and this is the one that takes the biggest swing in terms of what its difference to the rest of the movies in the franchise.
You are correct in everything you have said. Right, well, we will talk about the weird science and how it does and doesn't pay off and all of that good stuff soon. But first, it is your responsibility, as always, to give us a quick rundown on how Thor had done in the comics up until this point. Waxes and wanes, biggest arcs, all of that good stuff. So, Ben, go on, talk Thor.
So,
mention Walt Simonson, I dare you.
So Walt Simonson will definitely come up. Thor debuted in August of 1962 in a comic book called Journey into Mystery, which is still, it was one of Marvel's longest running books. It kind of goes in dribs and drabs and stuff like that. But yeah, he debuted in that. Stan Lee is the writer. Larry Lieber, who is Stan Lee's brother.
Stan Lee isn't his real name.
I'm saying that Stan Lee is actually called Stan Lieber, believe it or not. Larry Lieber was the writer, and then Jack Kirby, as always, was the artist on the creation of Thor. They ran for quite a few issues in Journey into Mystery. It eventually became Thor, as we all know it. And pretty much everything you know about the character Thor that is shown up in these movies was probably made by Jack Kirby and Stan Lee. However, the real cementing point of Thor in the Marvel comic pantheon is Walt Simonson's run in the 1980s/70s.
One of the prettiest comic runs ever.
Yes, it is. I mean, Walter Simonson is one of the all-time great comic book artists.
Very colourful, very psychedelic, very, you know, rainbows in space, that kind of good stuff. They also made Thor a frog at one point.
So Walter Simonson did indeed make Thor a frog in the 80s, only the 80s. I just want to correct that.
The 80s were weird. You know?
Yeah, it was. So basically every single thing you think of, Beta Ray Bill, like the idea of, I think the first Ragnarok, or the startings of the first Ragnarok were in this run. Walt Simonson did a hell of a lot on his run on the series.
Yes.
And then Thor existed after that. He wasn't the biggest character in Marvel's pantheon. There's a couple of fun bits. The immortal line, Ultron and I would have we would have words with thee, comes from an Avengers run in the late 90s. And then, basically, because the Thor book wasn't selling, they actually did Ragnarok. And Thor died and disappeared for about half a decade.
Yeah, they did that again in the mid-thousands, didn't they?
This is
oh, you're talking about that. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm talking about now, yeah. So basically Thor disappeared for about five years in that time.
That's why he's missing from Civil War.
And there's a Thor robot and all the rest of it. Yes. And then J. Michael Straczynski, best known for Babylon 5. He'd done the run on Amazing Spider-Man, and then after Babylon 5, and then his Thor run is probably the biggest single influence point over this movie.
Which is why he gets to be in it.
Which is why he gets a story credit. It doesn't take the actual conceit of his run, but it does take the conceit of the town where his run is set.
A very obvious movie studio. Like, when I watched that, I was like, this entire town looks like they built it. And then I was reading, and I was like, oh, they did. They built this entire town. Okay, cool.
I don't think it gets more clear until that final fight scene where they're, like, zooming out. And you're just like, this is just two streets.
Yes.
Like, this isn't a town. This is a couple of street corners that you made, and
it just looks too neat. Like, everything is too straight and
perfectly spaced. That's just America for you.
Anyway, Thor is good fun. So, I will now run down what the film is about. So, in New Mexico, a team of scientists led by Jane Foster are investigating unusual weather phenomena, and their truck collides with a large Australian man. We flash back, and Thor is about to become King of Asgard for some reason that is never fully established. When frost giants attack, against Odin's orders, Thor leads his brother Loki, the Lady Sif, and the Warriors 3 in an attack on Jotunheim, home of the frost giants. Have a big old fight. Odin intervenes, and when he brings Thor back to Asgard, he banishes him to Earth, stripping him of his powers for his arrogance and basically starting a war, maybe. We get some fun fish-out-of-water stuff with Thor interacting with humans. He then tries and fails to reclaim his hammer Mjolnir from a shield facility, and this humbles him. He starts falling in love with Jane. He drinks, he learns, he loves. Meanwhile, Loki has discovered he is not Odin's true son, and he starts plotting his way to the throne after arguing with Odin so much he falls asleep, which is a genuine thing. Thor's friends go and try and search for him, so Loki sends the Destroyer, which Ben mentioned, to stop them. Thor, having learned all his lessons, seemingly sacrifices himself to save them all, and this makes him worthy again. Mjolnir flies to him, he beats the Destroyer, he has all his powers and his cape, returns to Asgard, fights Loki a bit, stops his plot to kill the frost giants for some... I mean, that's vague. Loki falls to his apparent doom as Odin wakes up, and he has a little heart-to-heart with Thor. We end with Jane Foster looking for Thor, Thor pining for Jane. The Bifrost that connects the two realms is destroyed, so they cannot see each other. And in a post-credits scene after a Foo Fighters song, we get Nick Fury approaching Dr. Eric Selvig, who we will talk about, and he asks him to work with the mysterious Tesseract, which looks in no way like the Casket of Winters, which is a MacGuffin from this film. And Loki whispers in the Doctor's ear, influencing him, so he's clearly still alive. So even from that reading and from what you said earlier, I think the thing you cannot get away from saying about this film is it's very messy. There is an awful lot to like here, I think. A lot of it not realised enough to sort of say that this film is like really, really good. But there are so many sort of nuggets of ideas going on here that there's a little something here to cover almost everything. And like you said, it's a big risk. It's very ambitious what they tried to do here with all the films we had so far, all taking place on Earth, all with humans, one of which turns into a giant gamma monster. But, you know, principally still quite familiar to us. This is another world. These people have been alive for hundreds, if not thousands of years. No, definitely thousands of years. We've got Asgard, we've got space bridges, we've got Heimdall who can see across multiple realms, we've got frost giants, we've got all sorts of stuff happening. So it's very ambitious. And there's a very large cast who we will run down shortly, but I commend everything it tried to do here, and of the films we've discussed so far, this is probably my favourite. I mean, Iron Man 1, you know, the RDJ performance is what it is, like, it's crazy, but I would rather rewatch Thor than any of the films we've talked about so far. I think I'm higher on Thor 1 than your average person. I don't know how you feel about it. I know you are very critical of the mess, but...
If I'm looking at the Phase 1 films, I think this is the weakest of the origin movies if you kind of don't take Hulk. Incredible Hulk as an origin movie. Like, I think of the kind of the Trinity, it's the weakest of the three. But I also, the only reason I think it's the one that's kind of like, it's the only one that I've gotten like a level below the other two origin movies. And I think that, I mean, I think it's a better movie than Iron Man 2, and I think it's a better movie than Incredible Hulk. But I think there are certain things that Captain America and Iron Man establish tad better than this movie does. I think the central performance in Iron Man is head and shoulders above what Hemsworth is doing here.
Yeah.
But I don't think there are many performances of the heroes that are better than what Downey Jr. is doing. And this is obviously like Hemsworth kind of like big break in a lot of ways. Like he'd had Star Trek for the briefest of moments, but like he definitely was not a name. And I also think Evans is massively, massively underrated as Captain America, but that is a discussion for next week.
Yes, it is.
So I think this movie does about as good a job as you can get, because it does have this such a huge amount of pressure on it to get this to work. Because especially at this point in the MCU, this is the like one of the make it or break it moments. Like Captain America can probably coast along on it being a war movie, and it's out in 3 months. If Thor fails, then especially at this point, because Loki had been confirmed to return for Avengers, if this movie fails, then what is this franchise going to be going forward if they can't go into the kind of weird reaches of the Marvel Universe? And it establishes exactly what it needs to establish to get this movie to work. I just think it doesn't quite know which tone to settle into at this point. And I think it's very apparent that the next two movies in this franchise go to completely different directions with the two tones of this movie kind of establishes.
Yeah. I mean, those tones, I mean, like I mentioned, Kenneth Branagh, Captain Shakespeare, he he brings what he knows to this film. And I do think it's a logical lending to adapt this high fantasy Norse mythology stuff to a Shakespearean plot. Like, it's all very flowery language. I think Joss Whedon writes Thor better than he's written in this film. But in principle, I understand why they did it. And I think I like that a bit more than you do. But
I think that Branagh is 100% the right choice for this movie.
Yeah.
Like, this movie doesn't do anything too flashy, and I think Thor is better directed by other people, but I think the bona fides that Kenneth Branagh brings this movie help it massively, especially when it comes to the familial chemistry and drama that goes on between Odin, Loki, and Thor.
Well, yeah, like, we haven't even talked about them individually yet, but I think that is, for me, the thing that will keeps me coming back to the Thor corner of Marvel with a positive attitude, despite what happens in this movie, despite what happens in the Dark World and all the sort of negative takeaways. That bond between Odin, Thor and Loki and the sort of dynamics between them, I think, is incredible. And I think, obviously, Hemsworth is the least experienced of the three actors. We've got Chris Hemsworth as Thor, we've got Tom Hiddleston as Loki, and we've got Sir Anthony Hopkins as Odin. They, I think, rarely have a bad scene together. Every shot where Odin is standing in the middle and his two sons are either side of him, I think, is money. Like, they do it with the kids at the beginning, and then they do it when the frost giants attack and a few minutes later. And, you know, it's a shot they'll use again and again. Just the way that that family is portrayed, I think, is one of the early examples of, like, nuanced emotional storytelling that progresses throughout the franchise. Tony Stark will obviously do some great stuff, Cap will get some great stuff to do, but I always come back to these scenes where Thor doesn't hate Loki. Like, he genuinely is confused as to why his brother is working against him and is apologetic, even though he doesn't know what he's done. And Loki is resentful towards Odin for favouring Thor, but fundamentally he just wants his dad's approval, as we see in that final scene, which I think is tremendous from him. It is like the signature Loki moment for me, when he says, "I could have done it, Father, I could have done it for you, for all of us," with sort of almost tears in his eyes. Odin yelling at Thor, Loki yelling at Odin, Thor and Loki sort of bickering, but then still being close, and that will come up again in a couple of episodes' time. I just think it's so good, and it honestly, I think those three prop this franchise up as in Thor solo movies, until Taika Waititi arrives, because you take that away, you have a very messy couple of films. But I think, I mean, I can't elevate this entire film based on just this one element, but I think this is my favourite element in Phase 1.
That's completely fair. Like, I can see why you would think that. I also think that this movie, especially if you're comparing it to the sequel, has a sense of humour that the second doesn't. And that's not to say that there aren't amusing bits, but I know there are people who hate the kind of human comedy dynamic down on Earth and stuff like that, but I remember seeing this movie on opening weekend and going with a bunch of my friends from university and having just a really good time. And yes, the jokes aren't, they're a bit more basic than kind of like the quippy humour of Iron Man.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is a lot to enjoy about the kind of vaguely slapstick nature. Thor smashing the coffee cup on the floor is very amusing. And
I need a horse!
Yeah, like, again, like it's kind of obvious humour, fish out of water humour, but I do think Hemsworth is obviously having fun, and he will only get better at being able to deliver these kind of jokes as the franchise goes on. It's just a shame that the second movie kind of forgets that the first movie does have this very strong core sense of humour. And I think of the Phase 1 movies, I think it is probably the most intentionally comedic.
Mm.
There are funny elements in all the movies, but I think this is the one where the sense of slapstick.
Yeah. I think a part of it is Thor never feels vulnerable. Like, he always has a commanding presence, and he's like, oh, everything's going to be fine. And he's, like, bemused by everything that happens to him until near the end. And, you know, you've got that fish out of water stuff happening. And Asgard is, like, entirely foreign to us. So I think it does breed that sense of, you know, everything is fine. Whereas, like, Iron Man, while it is full of jokes, there are those genuinely, like, high drama, like, oh, is he going to be okay moments as well. So,
yeah.
So you mentioned Chris Hemsworth. Let's get into the cast. So, relative unknown, as you said, he'd done Star Trek. And, you know, his acting early on is a bit shaky. Some of the stuff with his accent, I want to know why, or whatever he says. But you kind of see this guy flourish as we go through these films, because I think he's very good these days. Early on, like, he's getting by a lot on physicality and having a lot of great people to stand across from as he acts. But physically, like, this dude is Thor. Like, Anthony Hopkins met him for the first time when they were both in, like, full armor, and he was like, well, this isn't going to take much acting. And I think Joss Whedon said something similar, like, when he first met Chris Hemsworth, he was like, oh, he's a 7-foot Australian god. This man is Thor. And, you know, he has so many abs, obviously. We all swoon when he stands there shirtless.
I did send you a picture of it last night.
He did. It's on my phone. The wig and the eyebrows are quite bothering to me. Because I saw this after I saw Avengers, so I got to experience Joss Whedon's take on Thor, and I believe they'd already improved, like, the costume and the makeup and stuff. So I guess if you just saw Thor and you weren't familiar with this dude, you were like, oh, okay, that's what he looks like, and then it would be fine. But as someone whose first image of Thor was what he kind of looks like now, to see him, to go back and look at this where he's got, like, bright yellow eyebrows and stuff, it's like, ah, what is happening here? You know, it's obviously his weakest outing in Marvel, but, you know, he's not awful. For, like, a complete unknown to step into this when all the other, like, lead characters have a lot more experience and sort of name cachet than him, I think he does okay. And when he grins, you know, your heart melts.
I have now loaded up a comparison of all the different costumes they've got, and even in this crudely animated form, you can see the massive improvement the costume makes in between movies. And I do like Thor with the kind of longer hair.
Yeah.
This kind of in-between mode that he has in this movie is not the one.
No.
I think he embodies the role of the character, but I think he is definitely finding his feet. Yeah. And I think a lot of what makes him good is having actors of the caliber of Tom Hiddleston and Sir Anthony Hopkins to kind of play off of.
Yeah.
But I don't think he gets his full potential until he's acting in a room with Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans and Mark Ruffalo and Scarlett Johansson. I think that's when you can see the kind of, like, the even more so the twinkle in his eye.
You can taste the amount that Ben wants to talk about Avengers. It's palpable. So, Thor's love interest.
We're so close.
I know. Thor's love interest, Jane Foster, played by Natalie Portman. Whenever I look back on her time in Thor, I have a negative impression. I was watching this last night, and she's better than I remember her being. That kiss at the end between them is one of the worst kisses I've seen in a major film. She, like, assaults his face, but maybe because he's, like, 8.5 feet taller than her, I don't know. Yeah, she's fine. She is believably intelligent, and I like the way she has a kind of confidence and self-esteem about her that allows her to sort of talk down to Thor in a way that humbles him. I kind of buy that, like, her talking shit to him makes him take note. And I also like the way she kind of plays some of the moments where he's being dreamy, like she's a bit schoolgirly, like, oh, he smiled at me. Like, without losing the integrity of the character. I don't know. I think because, I mean, I haven't seen Dark World in a little while, maybe all of my memories are correct, but I had a memory of her being bad, and I don't think she is bad, actually.
This is the movie where I think she has the most chemistry with Hemsworth.
Yeah.
I think some of my disappointment in it comes from this was the first movie I saw her in after Black Swan, where she is absolutely incredible. It's a similar feeling I had to watching Mickey Rourke after The Wrestler going into Iron Man 2.
Recurring theme.
Actors going from Darren Aronofsky movies to Marvel movies is always going to be a step down. So, but I do think that this is her best outing. I think she does have chemistry. I think she does also have chemistry with Stellan Skarsgård and Kat Dennings. Like, I don't think it's the best part of the movie, but I do think the three of them are amusing in their little... Yeah,
they're a fun little group.
Yeah, and I'm glad that the group is kept together, because in the second movie, I do think they're fun, but they are more fun here, and Natalie Portman is better with those two than she probably is with Hemsworth.
Yeah.
Even if she does have chemistry with Hemsworth in certain scenes. She is good, she is not Pepper Potts good.
No.
But she's also probably better than Liv Tyler, so...
Yeah, but there's also about four characters in Iron Man versus... I mean, we're going to talk about them all here, so you'll hear how many there are. You mentioned Stellan Skarsgård and Kat Dennings. I don't want to, you know, go too in-depth with them. Kat provides some good comic relief. It's a very busy film, so she doesn't get to do too much. I think she's actually funnier in the second one.
For some reason, of all the lines in the entire MCU, I think the most quoted one that I have...
Meow meow!
Is meow meow.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a good line.
It's a good fun line because it does... I think it very quickly explains to people who don't know the stupid way that can't even say it now. That Mjolnir is spelt. I think it does portray what a dumb word it is.
Yeah.
And yes, we're going to have some fun with this.
Hey Ben, what's Thor's hammer called?
Mjolnir.
There you go. Yeah. Stellan Skarsgård, you know, he's Stellan Skarsgård, man. Like, he's never awful.
He has some of the best-looking offspring in all of Hollywood.
He does. Well, you know, these Scandinavians.
One of them plays a clown and people still want to fuck him.
I know. I don't know how to get back on track from that. I like when him and Thor go and get drunk together. That's pretty fun. And Thor carrying him home over his shoulder.
I think he's probably the most surprising recurring character.
Yeah.
In the MCU. Yeah. Like, you look at this role now and you do not think he's going to show up in another three movies.
And yet. He will be naked and he will be...
At my university.
Yes. We're going to be talking about that, aren't we?
We are.
Right, let's move away from Earth. Oh, actually, while we're on Earth, Clark Gregg and Maximiliano Hernandez, Agents Coulson and Sitwell, it's more S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff. They are settling into it more. They're expanding how many people are in S.H.I.E.L.D. They show a more antagonistic, big government style side, I think, to them.
This is the movie where I think Clark Gregg came into his own. It's the movie where I think most of... Because Clark Gregg kind of gets shuffles off the board in Iron Man 2. Like, once Nick Fury shows up, he's gone, and then he gets the post-credits scene. But this is the movie where he feels like he's going to become a big part of what this franchise is.
He's large and in charge. He's keeping things close to his chest, but he is also nice and he's funny. And like, Thor says "son of cool" to him, and that is probably my favourite joke in the movie. It's not even clever, but I just like it.
This is also the Coulson that shows up in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Without a doubt. The character is still very much a sketch in Iron Man 1 and Iron Man 2, whereas this feels like he is an agent. But again, two more characters who are going to become recurring parts of the larger Marvel Cinematic Universe, yeah. which is always fun.
Speaking of characters who are part of the larger cinematic universe and S.H.I.E.L.D., Jeremy Renner makes his debut as Hawkeye. Doesn't get a credit, I don't think, and sort of goes up in a little weird crane thing and holds a bow at someone who is indoors and he can't see.
No, he does. They do the shot over the shoulder where, like, they've built...
Okay.
They've built the, like, little area in the middle where the hammer is open to the elements, okay. so he can see into that.
Alright. Well, he is there. They didn't have time to make him be someone's secretary like Black Widow, so yeah, Hawkeye debuts there.
I mean, he is... it's a fun cameo because he is fresh off the Hurt Locker and he is fresh off the town,
yeah.
so he's coming off two very well-regarded movies, but yeah, it's an odd move. I remember telling people when we watch this movie that, like, oh, he's going to be one of the Avengers, and everyone's like, really?
He just I think that's a reaction some people still have to Hawkeye. I mean, you know, they weren't what they are at this point in time, so they had to debut some characters within each other's movies to an extent. Like, I don't want to say they were, like, playing with fire or they were on borrowed time or anything, but, like, they were still taking pretty big risks. So if they want Hawkeye and Avengers... just shove him in Thor, why not? Samuel L. Jackson is back as Nick Fury. He continues to have very shaky dialogue. Stan Lee and Michael J. Straczynski play truck drivers in the sort of sword in the stone with Mjolnir in the ground scene. It's fun. Walt Simonson is in the film. He's in Asgard, where we'll be talking about characters from next. He's sitting at a table. That's quite nice, I thought. We're on Asgard now. So, Sir Anthony Hopkins is Odin. He's a bit weird. Like, his track record with Odin, I think, is quite inconsistent. I think he's really good here. But in sort of future films, I think he will have some laughably bad moments where he just looks like a lost old man. But
Are we including Thor Ragnarok, where he's literally a lost old man?
we are. But no, I mean, like, you know, this is Odin. This is Odin the Allfather. So, of course, you need to have someone like Anthony Hopkins come play Odin. I don't know who else could have played him. I know Stan Lee wanted to play him.
No.
Come on, Stan. Yeah, he just has such gravitas. He commands a room. He improvised the scene where he banished Thor or some part of it anyway, which is great. Just, yeah, he's so good. He's so good in this, I think. And I think lucky Chris Hemsworth to get some sort of on-the-job training with an actor of this caliber. And, you know, when you see him and Loki getting to have one-on-one dialogue with each other, it's like these two are having a lot of fun, aren't they? Getting to just act at each other in what is probably quite an easy role for both of them. But, I mean...
Yeah, that's the thing with Anthony Hopkins, is it feels like a lot of his late, like, in fact, most of his career, I'd say, he is probably sleepwalking through most of these roles.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was definitely sleepwalking through Westworld for a lot of it.
Oh, yeah.
yeah, like, Anthony Hopkins gives this movie so much gravitas. I don't think you can underestimate just... Is this probably the bigger or the most well-regarded get that the MCU's got so far?
Definitely, because... You have a lot, you know, you have Robert Downey Jr. who is struggling to rebuild his image. Edward Norton is obviously a great actor, but not necessarily like a huge like name. You know, you have a lot of bit part people and stuff like that. But Anthony Hopkins is like an actor's actor when he tries. And, you know, he's a Sir, for God's sake. And he's signing on to do this quote-unquote silly comic book film. And Marvel will continue to get huge names and it from here on out. And I think, yeah, this is one of the bigger ones.
Yeah, I mean, because obviously, like, he is one of the two Oscar winners in this movie.
Indeed.
But, like, and if you're looking at the previous Oscar winners, it's Paltrow and Jeff Bridges. In terms of, like, actors who get a lot to do, who bring it, like, he is the one so far.
Yeah. Like, he by no means had to do this film. Like,
no.
Some of these actors have to just keep working to keep their name out there and, like, they go where the trend is, but there is zero reasons Anthony Hopkins has to be in anything, to be honest. You wouldn't know it from some of the choices he makes, but... Oh, it's a really bad film with Chris Rock, where Chris Rock is, like, the twin of a secret agent who dies, and then Anthony Hopkins has to bring him in and teach him to be a secret agent in a week. It's awful, and I love it.
Bad Company?
Probably. I don't know. Anyway.
Directed by Joel Schumacher.
Ooh, you know you're onto a winner. It's good that we get him here being so good. Because he will have some wavery times going forward. Yeah, I mean, I can sit here and talk about the dynamic between those three all day, but I won't. But he is married to Rene Russo as Frigga, allegedly, in this film. Her first film in, like, 6 years, and she barely has a line. But I do like the recurring theme of Loki's relationship with his family, particularly his mother, where, you know, he is antagonistic towards Thor. He is antagonistic towards Odin, even though he, you know, we see the facade crumble and he does actually just want his love and approval. He never, ever lets go of the strong love he has for Frigga. Because, you know, he learns that he is not Odin's son and he immediately, it's an immediate change for him. Frigga's obviously not his mother, and yet he still treats her like she is. And that will lead to the single best scene in Thor 2. And yeah, I just like that in the middle of all his plotting, he kind of still has that nice little bond with her. But, I mean, Rene Russo is on a long list of people in this film who it's like, sorry you didn't get to do anything.
Like the four we're about to get to now.
I mean, I was going to go to Idris Elba next as Heimdall.
You mean the man who's on the poster, who gets almost nothing to do.
Yes. His partner's speech is very odd. I guess it's an intentional choice, but he's got a very stilted way of talking. And
for better or worse, it is now how I think Heimdall speaks in the comics. So if I ever read a comic book with Heimdall in, I do kind of put it in Idris Elba's voice, which...
Yeah. But I feel he does speed it up a bit in 2 and certainly 3.
Yes.
But anyway, he's here. I probably didn't know who he was when I saw this. He has a funny scene when he sort of allows the Warriors 3 and Sif to go to Earth when he's not supposed to. And he has his little tense standoff with Loki, but he's really just like, look how wacky Asgard is for now.
The point this falls in his career is utterly bizarre to me. Because he's been, like, The Wire is not the biggest show of all time. And I can't imagine he's getting a face on the credit based on The Wire. And Luther is a tiny British show at this point.
Yeah.
Maybe it's his stint on The Office he's just done. Like,
yes.
Like, Prometheus isn't until is another year away. Pacific Rim's 2 years away.
He did,
like,
The Losers, didn't he?
He did, but, like, that wasn't big. Like, I don't understand how the poster for this movie is Chris Hemsworth, Natalie Portman, Tom Hiddleston, Anthony Hopkins, and Idris Elba.
Maybe they knew what he was going to become.
Maybe they did know. And again, he is one of the few actors... Well, no, most of the actors do appear in all three, but he's one of the few actors in this movie who does get to have significant roles in the next two movies. And it's obvious that, like, they probably did kind of waste Elba's casting here.
Yes.
Like, there are probably other roles in the MCU that Elba could have been really good for, and having him as Heimdall kind of ties their hands a little bit.
Ironically, this may be the most enthusiastic he is to play Heimdall in real life.
Yes.
But we will get to that. He's a weird anomaly in this. So Jeremy Alexander as Lady Sif. I love her. I really wish that they did more with her, not just in this, but generally.
I think they could have done away with the Warriors 3 and just had Sif be there. Give her more time, and I think this move... You cut off some of that chaff, and I do think there are people who would complain about there not being the Warriors 3, but I do think if you give the screen time of the three of them to Sif, I do think you get a stronger movie that also has better female representation, yes. Which is something that is... Like, there are female characters in this movie that are all varying levels of good, but they are definitely massively underwritten in comparison to the core three, Loki, Odin, and Thor.
Yeah.
And just giving a little bit more to one of them, especially because Jamie Alexander feels like she's the one who's most enthusiastic by this role.
She throws herself at it. You can tell that she's loving doing it.
Like, she did 2 episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
And we also get, like, and when she doesn't come back for Thor Ragnarok, it continues the trend of actors not being able to be in Thor because of TV commitments.
She tried. Oh, and now Valkyrie's basically replaced her. Anyway, she has a good, like, physical presence. They don't fully play up the... Because, I mean, in the comics, Sif is... I don't know if she's more so his true love than Jane, but for a period of time, like, him and Jane were not together anymore, and he and Sif were played as, like, the true love. I think she gives him, like, a bit of a glance near the end, but she's fun, and I really do wish that she did more generally. So you got the Warriors 3, Ray Stevenson, Josh Dallas, and Tadanobu Asano. Really should practice these names before I say them out loud for the first time. Josh Dallas replaced Zachary Levi, who will be playing Shazam at the last
and will also be future playing Thandral.
Yeah, he takes the role back. It's one of the weirder little
but yeah, he had to not do the role because he was in, because yeah, the season 3 of Chuck was originally going to be 13 episodes, but they renewed it for another 6, so he had to drop out of filming Thor. For better, like, for better or worse, like, this is probably the movie where Thandral gets the most to do. But I do think of Zachary Levi as being my Thandral, just because I do quite like Zachary Levi.
Yeah.
Because I watch all of Chuck, so yeah. That is...
If there's one thing Ben knows more about than comic books, it's television generally.
We also should mention that Stuart Townsend was also cast as Thandral.
Yes.
But had to drop out, so this is another one of the many movies he's had to drop out of after he was initially cast as Aragorn and then had to leave.
I know.
What a step down, though, from going from being Aragorn in the Lord of the Rings trilogy to almost playing Thandral in Thor.
Well, Ray Stevenson was the Punisher, and now he's Volstagg, so... Yeah, okay. They have very few lines. Volstagg is the one that stands out the most to me, because he's, you know, he likes to eat, and he's very... He's got a big booming Brian Blessed voice. I don't know, he's just a happy, rotund individual.
They get to take part in a fight scene, or two fight scenes, but the,
in which
the first
they get
one...
their asses handed to them. Oh, the first one's okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Well... talk about that maybe. Yeah, we'll probably talk about it now because that's all the hero people. So it's time for Villain Watch. And I mean, I'm just gonna mention these people, but it's very obvious who we're gonna spend most of our time talking about. I think the Destroyer is pretty cool. Nice little nod to the, you know, Kirby-ish influence.
It's such a, like, the Destroyer was created by Jack Kirby, and it's nice to see probably the first, like, we get there's little bits and pieces of kind of Kirby design that kind of come through these movies, but this is probably the first one that's basically just wholeheartedly, this is the Kirby design on the screen.
Straight from the page.
They do the first Iron Man costume, but that's gone within about 5 pages, or 5 minutes of the movie. Whereas, like, the Destroyer gets a big central moment, and yeah, it's basically just designed to look cool. I think it's probably done away with a bit too quickly, or, like, anticlimactically, but, like, in terms of overall design, it is exactly what you want from one of these movies to take the comic book and put it into a screen.
Yeah, and you get the nice line of, oh, is that one of Stark's? Just bridging these films. Oh, also, Eric Selvig totally name drops Banner without saying his name at some point, so that's fun. Colm Feore as Laufey. So the Frost Giants are set up as the villains of this film, if you're an idiot and you can't tell that Loki's going to turn. The scenes where they're in are shot so incredibly dimly that you... I've seen this in the past on, like, worse televisions, and I just could not see what was happening at times.
It's like, that fight scene is so weirdly shot. Like, it's the most clear moment that Kenneth Branagh is not an action director, is that scene on Jotunheim, whatever.
Look at you.
Dumb Norse language.
Ooh, okay.
You're the one that's mispronouncing real people's names. I'm the one mispronouncing.
Yeah, I look forward to Guardians of the Galaxy and Thor 2. So, the Frost Giants, like, I think they look kind of cool. And like many things in this film, I wish they did more with them.
I really want to dig into whether or not the makeup company for this movie moved on to Game of Thrones, like, immediately afterwards, because...
The Night King, they look like White Walkers.
Yeah, the designs are a little bit too close to home.
Anyway, the star attraction here is Tom Hiddleston as Loki. Every episode, we have the opportunity to each nominate, but we must agree on, we have decided, an outstanding performer. We gave it to Robert Downey Jr. for Iron Man 1. We both agreed no one is, you know, doing themselves any favours in Incredible Hulk. And I think we went with Sam Rockwell for Iron Man 2.
We obviously went with Sam Rockwell
for Iron
Man 2.
Of course, all right, justice. I'm sure you won't disagree. I think Tom Hiddleston has to get a nod here. I know you want to do some tactical voting and save some votes so you can vote for multiple people, but I'm sorry. You will have to argue me down from this because he is incredible. The scene I quoted earlier when he's hanging off the bridge is fantastic. The scenes with Odin are great. And he's just a good little conniving chicken shit, pulling the thread behind the scenes bad guy. And it's not an illogical turn, because, I mean, you see them all being friends earlier on, and when they briefly are, it's kind of fun. And his motivations, I think, are very logical and earned, and it's not like he suddenly switches characters. And yeah, okay. I think, you know, it's going to be a tall ask for you to say that he shouldn't get a nod here when we gave one to Sam Rockwell.
Okay, so I have two questions for you.
Okay.
One is he better in this movie, or is he better in Thor the Dark World?
He is better overall in this movie than he is in Thor the Dark World, in my opinion. I think he has a couple of better moments in Thor the Dark World.
Okay. My second question is, if someone wins for multiple movies...
Yes, because we obviously nominated Robert Downey Jr., and he will continue to be quite good in things.
As will Tom Hiddleston. He has another two movies where he is definitely within a shot of...
Look, I feel if we have the same actor appearing more than once, I think we make them fight and one knocks the other off the list. But I don't think we can turn down a good performance now because we know maybe a better one is coming. I think this is an evolving list, personally. So I think we have a duty to put Tom Hiddleston forward now, only to knock him off potentially in 2 episodes' time, depending on how that argument goes.
But then we lose the chance to give someone a vote later on, because we're getting to the movies where there's an awful lot of people in these that are all very, very good.
There are, but I...
Who is the best person in Guardians of the Galaxy? Who is the best person in Civil War? Who is the best person in... I could go on.
Luckily, Ant-Man and other films will give us more opportunities to nominate no one, so...
No, Corey Stoll for Ant-Man.
Okay, dude. I don't know, look, Loki is... Alright, at the very least, if we're playing Villain Watch, this is the best villain we've had so far.
Oh, easily. Like, Loki is head and shoulders the best... I hesitate to say the best single achievement the MCU's done, because I do think he has become diluted with future movies.
Well, yeah, that's the problem they have, is they have suckier villains they have to keep going back. And, like, the fan response is so positive to him, it will be coming out of Avengers, that they have to keep bringing him back.
I am glad that he has the 4-year break that he did in between the last two movies he's done, because it made me appreciate him more in Thor Ragnarok.
Yes.
But then that movie has so much else going on that he was almost like a sprinkling on a cake rather than why I want to go back to a movie. And if I want to go back to this movie, it is a large part of it for Hiddleston.
Yeah.
And how good he is in this movie.
Yes. So we've established that. I think we need to establish the parameters of our best performances thing. Are we hoping to end up with a list of here are our top 10 performances in the MCU? Or are we looking at a sort of... You know, there are this many spots, and I don't know, because that will determine my thoughts on whether we should put him forward or not.
I mean, I am now going to espouse my I am an award show communist.
Okay.
I think things that we should spread the wealth as far as possible.
Okay.
So if I'm watching TV show awards, I'm always pro the winner from last year not winning 2 years in a row unless they really, really, really deserve it.
Absolutely.
So in this situation where I am thinking... We say this is Hiddleston's best performance as this character and give him the award now, and then bank another one later.
Yes.
Or we bank it now and then use it later. Because I'm going to push for one of Hiddleston's performances to be banked.
Okay. Because yeah.
You have to choose whether, because whichever one you choose, I will fight harder the next time.
I think Ruffalo and Black Widow are better in Avengers.
Thing. I've already conceded that argument. I'm going to have to choose one of the votes.
Right, okay. Alright, I think this segment is getting away from us a little bit. I would like to tentatively put Tom Hiddleston forward.
Okay, I will not object.
If he is later knocked off, maybe we can resurrect a pick or something like that.
Tom Hiddleston is fantastic. He is so good. And he's only going to get better. I am excited to discuss the next time he shows up.
He is a nominee for like MVP of the MCU, in my opinion, because they keep bringing him back, and he does, as he gets some bad material, he still works with it, and he continues to be a fan favorite. So another segment we do is, of course, good third act, bad third act. This, I think, is the best third act so far. It's not phenomenal. It's not a step up, but it's consistent with the rest of the film. The Destroyer fight is fine. I think the Loki Thor fight is surprisingly okay, given how overwhelmingly the physical odds are stacked in Thor's favor. I like him, like, leaving the hammer on top of Loki gently to pin him down. And, you know, I will wax lyrical about that Loki hanging off the bridge scene. And I actually like the optimistic note it ends on, because obviously the Bifrost is destroyed and you have Thor sort of gazing off at the stars, and he asks Heimdall if he can see her, and he sort of says, "She searches for you," and he has this nice little smile. So ends on a quite optimistic note, I think. So for me, I think this is the best third act so far. Off the top of my head, it might be the best third act in Phase 1, although after watching two seasons of Agent Carter and crying at Hayley Atwell, that might not be true for you. But and I will rewatch Captain America when we do that episode. But I would say this is in the good side.
This, yeah, I would, like, if
it's one or the other, I think it's,
yeah, good. if we're doing thumbs up, thumbs down, this is a good third act. It is very much in line with the rest of the movie. Like, it's not a steep decline or increase in quality. The thing that I think is most important is that it's not a fight against some massive CGI enemy. Like, there is the CGI enemy, but he's dispatched within about 2 seconds.
Yeah, he is a tool of Loki. He is not the...
Yeah, and so Thor gets his powers back. He shoves a hammer in the face of this, like, just undestroyable monster, and you get the moment like, oh, wow, Thor really is very powerful. And then it's back to Asgard, and it's literally just kind of the conclusion to... The strongest part of the movie is the relationship between Odin, Thor, and Loki. Like, that's where this movie succeeds that the others didn't, is that it's actually an emotional payoff in a lot of ways. That, like, it's not fighting against your business partner in a giant mechanical suit. It's not fighting a giant CGI monster in Brooklyn. It's not loads of nameless drones flying around LA or New York or wherever it is that the Stark Expo takes place.
So are you saying when it's two humans who make eye contact with each other having a moral disagreement while they fight, it's better?
Yes, I am, because people get to act. And I'm going to have to eat these words in about two movies' times. But for now, this is the most successful Act 3 of all the MCU, because it is about the character and it is... an actual conclusion to the movie, as opposed to a CGI slugfest designed to make it feel like we really should have paid the $200 million for this movie, or however much money the budget was. Because, I mean, that's the thing, is like, the only thing that this movie really has to show that it's that big a budget a movie is Asgard.
I mean, it looks very big. There's a lot of people in that hallway. It's a little bit too green screeny CG for my personal taste, but, I mean, that will come up when we talk about the sequel. But yeah, I mean, I think we can agree so far it's bad, 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 good for the for the third act. The trope is that all Marvel movies start good and end bad, so we have one outlier so far to disprove that.
Which is that this movie coasts through the same quality the entire time.
Yes. I wonder if we'll get one where it improves at any point. Ooh, who will know?
I think it's coming.
I will say that a reason that, because I mentioned this earlier, that so far this is my favourite film. And, you know, you can say what you want about that Robert Downey Jr. performance, but one of the things we were critical about Iron Man 1 for being is no one really goes on a journey and there's not a lot of meat to it. I think Thor does go on a more of a journey than Tony has so far, and more than Banner did. He is literally humbled by his father and by failing to pick up a hammer. And he learns to be a good person. And, like, you know, the trope of white dude learns not to be an asshole, like, that is obviously getting very tired. But, I don't know, I think that Thor goes on a nice little journey into mystery here.
I think it is, it's the strong, because it's a classical structure in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Like, because I was talking to you last night about the jump in tone between the comedy and the kind of more serious Shakespearean stuff is in itself probably very Shakespearean, in that even during tragedies there is humour, and it is very much kind of like there is one scene that is all high drama and monologues and soliloquies and whatnot, and then the next scene is bawdy comedy aimed at people in the front of the stage and stuff like that. And it speaks a lot to how good Branagh was as a pick for this movie.
Yeah.
I just think that the it feels messy in this context because it's not done with the same kind of like intelligence or wit that kind of you'd expect from that.
Sure.
From that kind of structure. So it comes off as a tad messier than you would hope.
Yes.
But in terms of the actual journey, like, it is that classical hero's journey as a backbone, which helps simplify the movie a hell of a lot and helps kind of like really bring home the dynamic that really do make this movie work, which is the familial stuff, like, yeah. And having it stripped back like that, like, you can, Loki's plot is complex to say the least. Trying to summarize the actual step-by-step motion of what Loki's plan is would probably take far too long, but it works on an emotional level.
Yeah. That's what I would say, is they lay a lot of groundwork and bank a lot of emotional cachet that they can keep going back to. And for how shaky Thor 2 is and stuff like that, and you know, Age of Ultron isn't... We'll get to that. But, you know, they do have these ready-to-go-to little character moments that rescue them when they are struggling, I think. And... I don't know, I would rather watch this than Iron Man 1, 2, or Incredible Hulk, if I had to, so...
I think it's an easier watch that probably does give more at multiple viewings than Iron Man does.
Yeah,
because Iron Man is a movie that's gone down in my estimation over time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've seen the trick, and, like, every time you see the one trick, it kind of is diminished, so...
Like, I think it's impossible to overestimate how important that movie is, and I do think that's why it still holds as high as it does in my overall rankings, but we both agree that it's probably not the best origin movie in Phase 1.
Yeah, whereas this, as you become, you know, as you become more attached to these characters, you can go back and have some fun with this film in a way that, you know, you can love the Iron Man characters, but going back to the first one, you don't get a huge amount out of them. Anyway, I'm going to say that's Thor. It's a very messy film that tries to do an awful lot. It doesn't completely shit the bed, and it's going to get two sequels. And I think Joss Whedon is going to do a lot in two episodes' time to help keep that character afloat and do good stuff for them. We're going to have Captain America next week. I'm very excited for that because Ben and I are some of the bigger defenders of Captain America 1 out there. So that's going to be fun. For now, this has been Thor. And to therealworld.com, Mike and Matt on SoundCloud. Sorry, Ben, you weren't around when I registered that, so maybe in the future. Check out our written stuff, check out our podcasts. I have lost track of where we'll be in time when this goes out. I guess you'll be able to listen to our Blade podcast by then. There should be a Lost podcast by then. Ben will have conflicted thoughts about it. But you can go have your conflicted thoughts, Ben. I am going to go away now. Thank you for doing this with me again, and we will see you next time. Say bye.
Bye.